The headlines: as the U.S. Israeli genocide in Gaza enters its 145th day, the UN warns of looming famine amid shortages of food and other essentials in the besieged strip. Israeli occupation forces suffer heavy losses during intense clashes with Palestinian resistance fighters. Two more troopers, including a commanding officer, are killed in the past 24 hours. And also in our headlines, thousands of Democrats cast uncommitted ballots for President Biden in Michigan primary in protest at his involvement in the Gaza genocide. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: the Israeli massacre of Palestinians in Gaza keeps unfolding as the regime pounds the blockaded territory with airstrikes and artillery fire. In the latest strikes, the regime bombed a residential building in Deir al-Balah, central Gaza Strip, killing at least two children. A similar strike in that area also left a woman dead and many others injured. The regime also fired artillery shells toward areas in southern and central Gaza Strip. The overall death toll now stands at nearly 29,900 since the onslaught began on October the 7th. Moti Abu Mosabeh joined us earlier from Deir al-Balah, central Gaza Strip, to give us details on the humanitarian situation in the besieged territory.
Since the very beginning of this onslaught on Gaza Strip, the Israeli occupation forces have been using the starvation and the humanitarian conditions as a weapon of war against the Palestinian people. They are aiming at pushing the Palestinian people to acquiesce and to bow under this unprecedented humanitarian conditions and to put more pressure on the Palestinian resistance. The humanitarian conditions are very catastrophic, and they are beyond catastrophic, because we are talking about at least 2.3 million Palestinian civilians. 60 to 70% of them are children and women. They have nothing to eat. Literally, they have nothing to eat. Everything that could be eaten was eaten by the Palestinian people. And according to multiple eyewitnesses from Gaza City and the northern parts of Gaza Strip, that the people there actually ate everything. They ate the grasses, they ate the animal food, they ate even anything. And if you have watched the videos coming from the Annapolis roundabout, as the Israeli occupation forces continuously attack the Palestinian people there, attempting to reach or to have an access to the food and the basic humanitarian needs, they have no problem to go so close to the Israeli tanks in order to get anything to eat, in order to snatch a bag of flour, of white flour, to feed themselves and their families. So these scenes actually are the manifestation of the Israeli continuous pressure in terms of the humanitarian conditions against the Palestinian people. Apparently, the people here in Gaza Strip are completely stuck and trapped under the continuous Israeli airstrikes, alongside the humanitarian conditions and the infectious diseases that are still hitting and still spreading among the people here in Gaza Strip.
International aid agencies are raising the alarm over the humanitarian situation in Gaza. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs is now warning of a looming famine in Gaza if a ceasefire is not established there. The UN official was speaking at a U.S. Security Council meeting on Tuesday. Addressing the same meeting, a senior official at the World Food Program echoed similar comments as he spoke about malnutrition in Gaza. More Israeli troopers are killed in battles with Palestinian resistance fighters in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli military has confirmed the death of two of its personnel, including a commanding officer in northern Gaza. According to the military, seven soldiers were also seriously injured in the fighting at the same location. The latest fatalities pushed the death toll among Israeli forces to 243 since the start of their ground invasion of Gaza in late October. Palestinian groups, however, say the regime is hiding the real number of the deaths of its troopers to avoid the Israeli public anger. Presidential primaries have been held in the U.S. state of Michigan as election campaigns are in full swing across the nation. Projections indicate that Donald Trump won the state's Republican primary by a large margin, strengthening his grip on the party's White House nomination. Nikki Haley, his last remaining rival, came in a distant second. Meanwhile, incumbent President Joe Biden is projected to have easily won the Democratic primary in the key battleground state, but a protest vote by Democrats angry over his support for the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza was growing as returns were counted.
Because I think President Biden is not doing the right things for the Palestinian who has the right to leave. You know what I mean? I believe in a peace in both nations, you know? Both nations should live in peace, but what going on there, it's unbelievable.
We collectively, I think anybody from a different party, anybody, go into the Democratic ballot and vote uncommitted, just so that it's multicultural, racial, it's a social issue that we're all being affected with, and we want just justice. That could come later, but let's call for a ceasefire right now.
President Biden has been under fire both at home and abroad for his unflinching support for the Israeli war on Gaza. Washington has not only provided the Tel Aviv regime with military assistance, but also vetoed several UN Security Council resolutions on the Gaza ceasefire. Many American voters rallying behind the Democratic camp cast uncommitted ballots in the primary in protest at Biden's pro-Israel stance. Well, the Israeli regime has conducted fresh raids on different areas of the occupied West Bank, injuring and abducting several Palestinians there. The regime forces attacked the cities of Ramallah, Jenin, Galilee, and Bethlehem in pre-dawn raids. A young Palestinian man was injured and seven others detained in Bethlehem. The incursions came just hours after Israeli forces fatally shot a 34-year-old Palestinian near a military checkpoint east of Bethlehem City. Earlier on Tuesday, three other Palestinians were also killed during raids near the city of Nablus. Since the onset of the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza in early October, Israeli forces and settlers have stepped up their attacks against Palestinians across the occupied territories. In its latest report, the UN said around 400 Palestinians, including at least 100 children, have been killed in the West Bank since then. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says a strong election marked by huge turnout of zealous voters is one of the pillars of running the country properly. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the remarks while meeting with first-time voters and martyrs' families. He said if people show the world that they are present and important in determining events across the nation, they will save the country and help it move forward. The leader's remarks came just 2 days before the elections for parliament and the assembly of experts. Iranians will be heading to the polls across the country on Friday to cast their ballots for the two representative bodies.
Iranian people are preparing for the Friday's elections, in which they will vote for their representatives in parliament and assembly of experts. Thousands of candidates, including women and the young generation, are vying for the seats.
Nearly 15,000 candidates are running for the election. Of these candidates, 12% are women and 63% belong to the young generation, which includes young activists aged between 30 and 50 years old.
Islami also mentioned different political groups and parties that are participating in the upcoming elections.
All of the country's political spectrums, including principalists, reformists, and independents, are among the candidates. A close contest is underway among them in the country's different zones and cities. According to the law, the parties can support a list of candidates as well as introducing their intended candidates.
In the meantime, 200 local channels have been launched for the candidates' election campaign.
The IRIB has launched 200 local channels, and the candidates can use them for their campaigns as well as the radio and social media.
Nearly 40 elections have been held in Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, which is a symbol of people's power and presence in the country's sensitive occasions. Iranians across the country will participate in the elections as they see choosing their representatives both in the parliament and assembly of experts as a duty to maintain the basis of religious democracy in their country. Farzana Ashuryun, Tehran.
The situation remains tense along Lebanon's southern border. The resistance movement Hezbollah and the Israeli military have once again exchanged fire. The Israeli military has intensified its attacks amid strong responses from Hezbollah fighters who have targeted Israeli bases as well as command centers, inflicting heavy losses on the regime in recent weeks. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh is joining us now from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, with more details on the situation. Mariam, what do you have to share with us?
Now, although we still have statements from Hezbollah this morning, we do know that salvos of rockets have been targeted from the Lebanese side into occupied Palestinian territory, into the Israeli settlements. We know that there were definitely rockets that hit the settlement of Kiryat Shmona. Of course, the Israeli media, as well as amateur videos, have shown that their sirens have been sounding in several of the northern settlements, in addition to the fact that the Iron Dome defense system by the Israelis has also been activated. Some saw some of these rockets from the defense system actually exploding in the air. Now, whether they were able to intercept a rocket or two, perhaps, but we know that there were other tens of rockets that were able to strike their targets. Now, this comes also after a very long night of exchanges of fire. The Israelis launched shelling into areas that are also areas which they have not targeted before, that are relatively far away from the border. We're talking about the towns of Sadiqin, we're talking about the towns of Taibe as well, and Subin, as well as Beit Leaf and Al-Khirbe also. These are towns that are not usually targeted, but have been also part and subject of the Israeli shelling recently and increasingly. And Hezbollah also seem to hit the Israelis where it hurt. They have targeted for the first time one of the main divisions, the 146th Division, in the headquarters, in the command center of the Golan area, and that is in the area of Jatun, and that is the first time that Hezbollah targets that area specifically. We're talking about at least 16 kilometers away from the border. And even through that, we know from the Israeli media, although Hezbollah did not specify the type of rockets, they said that there were several Katyusha rockets that were targeted because Hezbollah was retaliating for Israeli shelling on residential areas and civilian areas. But there were also a lot of anti-tank missiles that were used. And that is basically one of the main topics that the Israeli analysts are talking about in their media. They're talking a lot about the fact that the Israelis still do not have any strategy or tactic to be able to defend themselves or stop Hezbollah from launching these anti-armor missiles that they are using in a manner that is quite new. It's efficient, it's developed. In addition to the Cornet that they're using against the armors, the tanks, and so on, they're also being used against facilities and Israeli soldiers. And so we've heard also from Hezbollah statement saying that because now this is a different confrontation, it's not one-to-one, it's not a direct combat. We're talking about the fact that they need to target fortifications, they need to target tanks, they need to target also the soldiers themselves. We're talking about individuals, the personnel of the Israeli military. This is why they needed to find a new way to use the anti-tank and anti-armor missiles, and they have been using them in a manner which is quite effective. And we have seen that there were many casualties that have fallen, though, today as well. We know that there were helicopters from the Israeli side that are taking casualties to the hospitals. And of course, since that area is a closed military zone, we know that most probably the casualties are within the military personnel and Israeli soldiers, most probably. The destruction also is something that the Israelis are talking about. There's a lot of destruction on the Israeli side, in addition to the fact that, of course, the Israelis have continued to target Lebanese infrastructure and civilian areas. And we also have the fact that the Israelis are talking about the fact that they have really caused damage, that Hezbollah has caused damage to the Mirun base. And this is an air base that is very significant. It is very strategic. And they're talking about the main monitoring center. They call it 1BA 506. That was really damaged by Hezbollah's rockets, in addition to the other damage that they spoke about, and that the Israelis are basically trying to grapple and dodge all of these anti-tank armors and anti-armor missiles, and it still seems to be extremely difficult. Of course, that comes also in light of the fact that the Israelis continue their threats and that they want to escalate the situation. There is what we're looking at is an escalation, but some are talking about the fact that this is basically the thunder or the escalation that comes just before the calm or the truce that will definitely also play out in Lebanon if it does, if it is implemented in Gaza.
All right, thanks a lot. Mariam Saleh joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Well, the UK government continues to support Israel's ongoing genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip. It's the people in Britain who are bearing the cost of it. Said Putas explains how.
Filling up the tank, emptying out the pockets. Britons are again having to pay more for fuel. Petrol prices are up more than 3p per liter at the time of this report, while diesel has risen by 4p. That means the cost of filling up a typical family car in the UK has now increased. Prices had supposedly bottomed out from the record highs in 22, in large part caused by the UK and other NATO countries' self-imposed sanctions on Russian energy imports at the start of the Ukraine war in the same year.
The new pump price increases have been brought about by a recent jump in the price of oil. And one reason for that can be sought in the foreign policy decisions by the UK and its allies in the energy-rich Middle East.
Decisions such as supporting Israel's ongoing genocidal war on Gaza, which has led Yemen's armed forces to launch attacks on Israel-bound ships, including UK vessels.
There is a rise, obviously, to do with the fact that the tankers are not able to go through the Suez Canal because the insurance rates have gone through the roof if you try to do that. So they're diverting the tankers around the, you know, Cape Horn of Africa. And that is, of course, means that the shipping costs are getting higher because there's less ships available than normal. And also, you know, transportation costs, labour and hiring the tankers for longer.
The British Chambers of Commerce says more than half of the UK retailers and exporters have been affected by the disruption to the Red Sea trade, with a 300% increase in the price of shipping a single container from Asia to Europe. All this as the UK-US bombing of Yemen continues, essentially adding fuel to the fire.
Yemen is embracing, implementing international law by trying to prevent a genocide, and it's absolutely absurd for the UK government to go along with the US empire in actually bombing these Yemeni positions. Actually, as a result of that, causing a situation where the cost of living is increasing in Britain because of the ridiculous foreign policy that our politicians are embracing.
So what we have here is the British government tying the welfare of its own citizens to that of a rogue regime intent on committing genocide. Saeed Pourreza, London.
That's a wrap for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Dubbed a mighty legal battle waged by South Africa at the International Court of Justice, ICJ, against the Zionist regime for its genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza, some apologists for the Zionist entity have raised the mantra that the case was a futile exercise. To their dismay, however, the top UN court upheld South Africa's request and ordered the Zionist regime to take all steps to prevent genocidal acts in the besieged Palestinian territory. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. CB wrote, between then and now, all evidence points to the fact that not only has the Zionist regime disregarded the ICJ ruling, but has blatantly acted against it by intensifying its murderous campaign against Palestinians in Gaza. It is due to this flagrant violation of the ICJ ruling that the Geneva-based human rights organization, the Euromed Human Rights Monitor, issued a statement calling on member states of the Hague-based ICJ to cut off all forms of political, military, and economic relations with the Zionist regime. In an important exercise over the course of the 4 weeks since the ICJ decision, and as part of monitoring South Africa's lawsuit against the Zionist regime for violating its obligations under the Genocide Convention, Euromed Monitor has documented several Israeli regime violations since October 7, 2023. Six fundamental indicators were used by Euromed Monitor to track Israel's level of compliance with the ICJ ruling: mass killing, causing serious physical or mental harm, imposing living conditions meant to purposefully cause material destruction and starvation, obstructing the delivery of humanitarian supplies, imposing an environment meant to prevent childbirth, and public incitement to continue committing genocide. The result of the Euromed's monitor's research demonstrates that, from evidence it examined, Benjamin Netanyahu's army is still carrying out genocide against the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip. The persistent violation of international law and the Geneva Convention in utter contempt of the highest court of justice has led 50-plus countries to make oral submissions to the top UN court based in The Hague on the illegality of occupation, settlements, and apartheid. Though these are distinct from South Africa's genocide case, they point to widespread global outrage against the Zionist regime's arrogant behavior, and unprecedented indeed for so many countries to emerge one after the other and fearlessly make formidable legal arguments as to why the ICJ should hold Israel accountable. However, the first important test these countries have to pass is one of integrity. The second crucial test rests on whether they are committed to acting under strong concerns. According to Euromed Monitor, during the period since the ICJ ruled a halt on genocide, Netanyahu's army has killed over 3,847 Palestinians, including 1,306 children and 807 women, and injured approximately 5,119 people, bringing the total number of Palestinian deaths since October 7th to 38,067, including 14,350 children, 8,620 women, and 8,000 people who are still buried beneath the debris of demolished buildings or on the streets. And the bloody juggernaut rolls on in utter disdain for the prohibitions imposed by the ICJ. It's a pattern all too familiar with Palestinians, who correctly argue that while denunciation is necessary. The Zionist entity will remain defiant unless accountability is enforced via concrete steps. The necessary actionable steps are recommended by Euromed Monitor, with which the Media Review Network concurs, include cutting off all political, economic, and most importantly, military ties. Unless such measures are undertaken, the apartheid colonial entity will regard it as a license to continue its genocide against the Palestinian people. It's important to note here that, on the same score, 30 UN experts have demanded an immediate halt of arms exports to the Zionist regime. They asserted that any transfer of weapons or ammunition to Israel that would be used in Gaza is likely to violate international humanitarian law and must cease immediately. They added such transfers are prohibited even if the exporting state does not intend the arms to be used in violation of the law or does not know with certainty that they would be used in such a way, as long as there is a clear risk. Referring to the ICJ decision, the UN experts rightly conclude that the need for an arms embargo on the Zionist regime is heightened by the International Court of Justice ruling on January 26, 2024, that there is a risk of genocide in Gaza and the continuing serious harm to civilians since then. Far from normalizing with genocidal Israel, as some Arab despots are inclined to do, solidarity with Palestine's freedom struggle requires a comprehensive boycott and effective arms embargo of the apartheid regime.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hezbollah has targeted an aerial surveillance base in the Upper Galilee region with 40 rockets, and this target being deeper inside the occupied territories this time. The attack was in response to the Monday Israeli strike on the Lebanese city of Baalbek that left two civilians dead. The resistance group has also shot down an Israeli drone over southern Lebanon. Hezbollah and Israel have been engaged in clashes since the Israeli regime launched its genocidal war on Gaza in early October. Meantime, truce talks are also ongoing in the Qatari capital over the genocidal war in Gaza. So what's the future holding for Gaza? Where is the Hezbollah-Israeli conflict heading for? Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in this edition of the program. Elijah Magni, your journalist and political analyst, is joining us from Brussels. Also with us will be Merva Osman, journalist, political analyst, and host of Press TV's mainstream program out of Beirut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
let me welcome both my guests to the show, beginning with Elijah. This genocidal war that the Israeli regime has waged, Elijah, on Gaza, has impacted the region. It has kind of spread. You know that resistance fighters have not been sitting idle by. They have been performing their own retaliatory operations. Now, we're talking about Hezbollah in this episode more. Hezbollah is one of them, and it seems that some analysts maintain that even if the war in Gaza stops, the tension between Tel Aviv and Hezbollah could linger on. Do you agree with that? And if so, where could that end up in?
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I'm not sure that Israel can afford to see the war continuing on the Lebanese borders because of the Hezbollah capability that has manifested in the last 4.5 months. And we have seen how Hezbollah gradually used sophisticated missiles, drones, heavy rockets, and proved the capability of selecting specific and precise military targets all along the 100 to 110 kilometers all along the Lebanese borders. Moreover, we have seen also drones going more than 90 kilometers inside Palestine, bypassing even Haifa, and we have seen how the Hezbollah bombarded the Golan Heights, Safad, and other targets, showing that it can keep up with the Israeli challenge. However, what has been introduced recently was the anti-air missiles that drove the Israeli totally out of their balance when the drone, the Hermes 450, that can fly up to 20,000 feet, was downed by the Hezbollah anti-air unit. This is why Hezbollah is showing its military capability and is hiding even much more. The Hezbollah started the war, and Hezbollah is saying that is ready to shit. Israelis are only saying that they will continue if the diplomatic mediation has failed or will fail in convincing Hezbollah to stop the war. Therefore, it is always conditioned with an element that the Israelis are making sure they offer it to the audience that they really don't want to engage in all-out war immediately and have only this option, even if they have instructed their people that the war will last until the beginning of the month of August.
Okay. Now, Marwa, of course, there is this division among the Israeli officials. We know about that. And we have some radical one of like the Israeli war minister, Yoav Gallant, saying that there will be no decline, in his words, in Israeli action against Hezbollah, even if the ceasefire is agreed upon in Gaza. And we'll talk about the ceasefire later in the show. So do you share the same view as Elijah?
I share nothing as Elijah, and Elijah knows very well why I share nothing as Elijah. I didn't know that he will be here. If I knew that he will be here, I wouldn't have accepted the invitation. But anyhow, since I am a daughter of Press TV and a worker at Press TV at the same time, and being as a guest today, not as part of Press TV, I'll continue out of respect for the producer who had me here but did not tell me that this will be the second guest. And as you know, Behrouz, I cannot just stay calm about anything in my life. And this is one of the stances that I should say, that apparently your second guest now finds it possible to be on Press TV after years of being very critical against Hezbollah, Press TV, the Axis of Resistance. I'm really surprised he's here. Anyways, talking
stick
about...
to the point, please.
Yeah, I will get to the point. Talking about what is happening, especially what Yoav Gallant said, I think you've heard Yoav Gallant say the same thing in the first ceasefire that was announced in the war on Gaza. I think it was the first after the first month and a half. And I think that it was not necessarily a message towards his own people as much as it was some sort of a message towards the internal Lebanese society, by trying to threaten them not to go back to their houses in the event that there was a ceasefire announced, because even if a ceasefire gets hold of Lebanon as well after it gets hold of Gaza, the Zionist Israeli settlers will not go back to their settlements. And the reason why is that they have made it clear that they will not go back even if a ceasefire is made with Lebanon, because they don't feel safe. This is what they are saying. So Yoav Gallant is trying somehow to keep also the Lebanese border out of, keeping the Lebanese people out of the Lebanese border as well, because he knows very well, even if the ceasefire takes place, the Israeli settlers are not going back, because they are demanding a conclusive truce, some sort of a peace plan with Lebanon, or else they will not return. And we have heard a lot of issues being discussed about this matter, over the fact that there are some political people being sent to intermediate in Lebanon, especially from the United States of America, telling Hezbollah that there might be some sort of a political solution that they might reach with the Zionist entity, a political one rather than a military one. And Hezbollah said that, repeats what they keep saying, repeats what we heard Said Hassan Nasrallah say since the beginning of the war on Gaza up until now, that Hezbollah will stop when the war on Gaza stops. And Said Hassan Nasrallah, in his last speech, he made it clear that in the event of a ceasefire in Gaza, Hezbollah will stop fire. But if the Zionist entity continues to fire, Hezbollah will fire equally in a deterrent manner, the same manner that we have been seeing. Yes, it has been escalating, but at a very, very slow pace. But at the end of the day, it is being confined to certain areas, to certain targets, and not getting involved, for example, with the capital or with major residential areas, despite the fact that Zionist Israel always bombards residential areas and claims that it is targeting Hezbollah depots, when in reality, and after the Lebanese authorities investigate, they find that they are either privately owned companies or residential areas where literal Lebanese civilians were just living with their families there.
Okay. Now, Elijah, Lebanese resistance fighters, they've mainly targeted Israeli military positions, but you see that the Israeli regime has targeted residential areas in Lebanon and causing the death of a number of civilians there. So it's not only the Gaza Strip that you see this. Tel Aviv's disregard is everywhere for civilian lives, no matter where. Now you see this also noticeable in Lebanon.
Because Israelis are careless about civilian lives, we have seen how little importance they give to the Geneva Convention and to the international laws in Gaza. They have done that in the past against Lebanon in the many previous wars. This is why it is not surprising when we see the Israelis trying to target the Lebanese civilians and trying to drag Hezbollah into a wider war. This is something that Hezbollah is very conscientious about, and this is why Hezbollah is limiting always the fight and the war in support of Gaza, so the Palestinian cause is always in the center of attention, and bringing back the Israelis to the same rules of engagement and imposing deterrence on the Israelis, even if sometimes what the Israelis do is quite painful when they kill civilians that are supposed to be spared. But at the end of the day, the world is dealing with the most immoral army in the world, and we have seen how the Israelis are behaving, have behaved in the past, and are behaving today in Palestine. So I am not surprised to see this behavior of the Israelis, and trying always to hit those who are the weakest in any war.
Right. And Marwa, lots of people have been displaced from both sides of the border, especially from the Israeli side. Thousands of people have been displaced in this exchange of fire between the two sides, Hezbollah and the IOF. And I remember Hezbollah chief warning the Tel Aviv regime just recently, maybe a couple of weeks back, that if they take further steps and if they move toward further escalation, Hezbollah will do something so that the, you know, Israelis have to be actually forced to evacuate maybe 2 million Israelis close to the border. So I want to ask you, do you Would you expect this in any way to turn into a full-fledged war? And if that happens, who would be the loser at the end of the day?
Beirut, I think the only option that this might end up being a full-fledged war is directly related to the preliminary results of the U.S. elections. It has nothing to do whatsoever with what the Israelis want or can do, because if it's only about the Israeli capability, it is definitely a no. The answer to your question would be a no. But we have to look at it from a wider angle. If the Biden administration is not going to be able to stop Donald Trump from returning to power, I think the U.S. might go ahead and, in order to try and use Code 606 for their own country, which means stopping the elections because of a major war that might take place that would end up having the United States of America get involved, then yes, the answer to your question would be yes. But at the moment, reading what's happening, looking at the regional politics, the international politics, and the U.S. politics, and also diving into the internal Israeli politics, when you see how the protests against Netanyahu and the war cabinet in general is escalating, people are going back to the streets, same as they did before the war, because if you remember, they were in the streets for like 54 to 56 weeks trying to get rid of the Netanyahu government because of the reform plans that they wanted to impose on their judicial system. Now we are seeing a return to the protests, not with the same intensity, but it is being said that in the event that a ceasefire happens, we will see protests in the streets the same way we did before. So that's a more pressure on the Israeli government to stop the war. So if it is only according to the variables that are found inside of the Israeli entity, the answer is definitely not.
Okay. Now, Elijah, let's now take a glance at the situation in the Gaza Strip and related developments there. Qatari Foreign Ministry spokesman Majid Al-Ansari says that Doha is optimistic that a deal on a ceasefire will be achieved before Ramadan. And also we have U.S. President Joe Biden hoping that this will happen by next Monday. But Hamas, speaking of some big gaps to be bridged before a deal is reached, is a deal around the corner, in your opinion?
I think the ceasefire is something that everybody wants at the moment. But what Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to do is to bring a goat in a farm at the last moment. Because he feels in a strong position, and he feels by starving the population, by continuing the bombardment in Gaza, even if he has not achieved any of the declared objectives at the beginning of the war, he can twist the arms of the Palestinian resistance because he doesn't care about the 136 Israeli prisoners. So what he's trying to do is he's trying to accommodate the American pressure, at the same time the families of the prisoners, by releasing a small number. There have been a talk about 40 prisoners to be released in exchange of a certain number of Palestinian prisoners that has not been agreed upon yet. But at the same time, it is important to keep the Muslims away from fighting during the month of Ramadan. That will end also by the beginning of the Jewish feast that would last for 7 days on the 22nd of April. So this kind of combination, it is a suitable for the Israelis and for the Palestinians to breathe a little bit and to have less bombardment on a daily basis against the civilians, allow the civilians to go and see what happened to their beloved one, or if they can find something still standing, or perhaps have more humanitarian aid, because Israel has been violating the ICJ order and the international laws and committing war crimes and crimes against humanity by denying the population the basic service, a basic need to survive, and denying them water, food, and electricity. So for that, I think the problem are the details of the deal, and Netanyahu is trying to squeeze as much as possible to give less concession and to offer himself as a good negotiator to his people, and at the same time plan to continue the war on Gaza after the ceasefire.
Now, Marwan, you know that Netanyahu has also threatened to launch this military assault on Rafah, and you know what the situation is in Rafah like. More than a million Palestinians have been forced into displacement there, and some of them are being starved to death, another weapon that, unfortunately, Israel is using, apart from all those, you know, U.S.-made weapons and all that that they are using against them. They're also being starved to death, dying of some preventable diseases. So Netanyahu is just saying that the attack on Rafah will happen, definitely, that's for sure, and a possible ceasefire deal would only postpone it. So let's have your assessment of the situation.
I think that he means it, and I think that the Biden administration, despite the fact that they keep saying that they don't like it, they would see a catastrophe coming out of it, or that they have many times asked the Israeli entity not to harm any civilians while the Rafah operation is underway. They did not tell the Israeli entity they're not allowed to initiate any sort of ground invasion or air invasion against Rafah, which means that the United States of America actually gave the green light for such a horrific operation that might end up in a second phase of the genocide that we witnessed before, and we are still witnessing massacres that come out of this genocide. So I think that if there is something that would stop Netanyahu, it would have to be some sort of internal pressure or elevated resistance coming from Palestine in specific and the axis of resistance by default. But if Netanyahu is to break that ceasefire, which is also a possibility because we saw how the first part of the Paris talks just went down the drain because Netanyahu felt like it and decided that he wants to finish off with Khan Yunis and probably start something in Rafah, but was then stopped by the Americans for the sole purpose of approaching Ramadan and what Ramadan means, the holy month of Ramadan means for all Muslims and especially the Muslims of Palestine who would go and pray in Al-Aqsa and not allowing them or continuing the genocide during the month would only elevate and escalate the situation against the entire axis of resistance. But in case Netanyahu decides to break the ceasefire or wait until the ceasefire, which is supposedly according to certain sources coming from Egypt and Qatar, that it would be around 45 to 50 days, if he's going to wait 45 to 50 days and then relaunch that attack on Rafah, I think the first thing that he would be doing is pushing the current displaced people, the refugees in Rafah, either to Gaza or northern than that, but under the condition that he's been stating several times right now, whether in the Zionist media or elsewhere, that he will not allow men to go with the women and the children and the elderly. So I think what we saw in the northern part of Gaza, where the Israeli entity occupation forces entered forcefully with Merkava and whatnot to basically just incarcerate everyone there, including the paramedics and the doctors and the nurses and everyone involved in helping, directly helping the civilians, will happen again in Rafah, and he might take advantage of this 40 to 50 days truce to maybe let off some of the civilians who will either accept going back to the north under certain conditions or completely leaving into the Sinai desert. And either way, it's a catastrophe. Okay. It's a second Nakba for the Palestinian people.
Okay, Elijah, how do you look at this? What's going to become of Rafah?
I don't think the Israelis can afford not to occupy Rafah because Benjamin Netanyahu have said already that he has still four Hamas battalion to deal with in the area of Rafah. However, he needs to look after the 1979 Camp David agreement with the Egyptians because he's not allowed to put more than four battalions on the borders with Egypt. That will require a lot of effort, international effort and pressure from the Americans. Nevertheless, the resistance can never be defeated because we have seen how he claimed to have occupied the north and occupied the middle, but occupying is something and controlling something else. The resistance is still bombarding the Israeli settlement from the north. The Israelis are still bombing the north with artillery and airplane, which means that there is still significant resistance in the north, and he is still engaged in Khan Yunis. Therefore, everything he's saying is just to keep the battle as long as possible, allowing him to sort out his domestic affairs and make sure that there is no strong appetite for a very early election where he is going to be accountable for all the mistakes that he did, according to the Israeli society, on the 7th of October, and also the corruption charges. Therefore, it is not a promenade that he's going to go to Rafah, because the Palestinian resistance is still strong. Moreover, the international community, although they are finding excuses for Israel, saying you need to displace 1.5 million internally displaced Palestinians from Rafah, it is not that easy to send an army operating on the ground with so many civilians around, even if he doesn't care a lot about civilians. So between what he's saying and what he can do, there is still a huge gap. And this is why the ceasefire will allow him to reorganize himself, or perhaps something new can be presented during the time of the ceasefire, when longer negotiation can be presented and available, and that can relieve both sides.
Okay, that's all the time we have. Let me thank my guests, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst in Brussels, Marwa Osman, journalist, political analyst, and my colleague in Beirut.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
An-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdha al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaik.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue,
an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Dialogue. I'm your host Mahdi. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was a pure source of wisdom and knowledge. Despite his young age, he showed what divinely gifted knowledge really looks like. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the 10th divinely appointed Imam, and he was the 10th divinely appointed successor of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the son of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. After Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam answered with the answers of an expert the most difficult of questions posed to him by the Shia scholars and jurisprudents, the Shia leaders at that time had more faith and certainty now of what they had previously believed, that a divinely appointed Imam must have the most knowledge, and he must be the most knowledgeable one of his time, regardless of whether he is young or old. And so the knowledge, virtue, and the delving into the sciences of the Holy Quran and the Sunnah of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam astonished the minds and sparked meetings and gatherings in all parts of the Muslim world. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Jamiatul Kabira by Imam Hadi alayhi salam, along with its English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. As-salamu ala a'immatil huda wa masabih at-tuja wa a'lam at-tuqa wa dawin nuha.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thoughts, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call in the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu ala mahal.
Peace be upon the exponents of the recognition of Allah, the centers of Allah's blessing, the essence of Allah's wisdom, the keepers of Allah's secrets, the bearers of Allah's book, the successor of Allah's prophet, and the progeny of Allah's messenger. May Allah send blessings upon him and his household. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, the 10th divinely appointed Imam. Now, one of these dialogues that is quite interesting, and of course we've been talking about it for quite a few programs now, is this dialogue that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam has with one of his